The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, let's hope that they turned on the recording. Let me tell you who I am, and then tell you what it is that I have to tell you, and tell you how long it's going to take. My name is John White. I'm here from Practicing Law Institute. And let me just tell you a little bit about Practicing Law Institute. Practicing Law Institute, PLI, was founded on the basis that you learn a lot in law school, but you don't learn much about being a lawyer. When you finish, you're really smart, but in terms of representation, your skills are probably kind of limited. So they give you courses. Now, these courses matter, of course, once you're finished with law school. But here's the secret. While you're in law school, what PLI has to offer is, for the most part, free. And they offer about 600 courses per year. And you can get a scholarship to them simply by being a law school student. And what's nifty about that is these courses are across the board in all subject areas. Not just patents, but anything, you know, securities, contracts, landlord tech, whatever it is that's interesting to you. And you can go there for free. Likewise, so can any of your peers. So it's not just the people that showed up in this room. So take advantage of that. They give their courses in New York and San Francisco because that's where they're headquartered. But many are also given in Washington. So, as they say, take advantage of them. And use that opportunity to learn about things that you might be interested in because of a law school class. Well, PLI will help you determine whether your interest is genuine, okay? And then you can persist with that interest or forever know that it's not interesting having actually attended one of these things. All right, let's talk about what I'm going to talk to you about now, and that is, I'm going to talk to you about the patent bar exam, getting ready for it, when you should take it in your law school existence, and so forth. And then I'm going to tell you about careers in patent law. And what I have to say will take about, 40 minutes. And so what is your next commitment, all of you? Do you have something at, say, 5:30? Is that when you are, you're all free for the rest of the night? Well, I speak at about, I don't know, 100 law schools a year, so. Thank you.
Okay.
Can I say I had cold water?
Okay, yes. Is that all right?
That's perfect.
Okay.
And so, let's talk about the exam. First of all, the exam has been around for a long time, about 50 or 60 years, and it's unique in that the Patent Office is the only government entity that sees fit to give you an exam before you can practice before it. Most government entities are happy if you're merely a lawyer, and then you can go ahead and represent people, but not so the Patent Office. The Patent Office, in fact, doesn't even care if you're a lawyer. They don't care if you're in law school. Indeed, they don't care if you've taken and passed multiple bar exams. What they care about is, have you taken and passed their exam? So what is this exam? Well, firstly, let's get rid of some myths about the exam. And the first myth that pops up from time to time and gets put out there is that the exam is going to go away. That they're going to do away with it because, after all, it's unfair and only the patent office gives it and all that sort of thing. Okay, well, I'm here to tell you that's not going to happen, all right? So waiting it out is not a strategy. So myth number one dispatched. Next, you may well ask patent attorneys, tell me about this exam. What was your exam experience like? And they'll tell you something, but what you have to realize is that over time, the exam has changed. And, you know, it changes along with technology and so forth, but a few things have been put away. The first thing is, there's no more written component. You don't actually have to write anything. It used to be up until 1997, there was a written component. That's 11 years ago now, it's been done away with. It was the afternoon. And in addition to being in writing, there was a technical elective section. You actually had to be skilled in mechanical, electrical, and chemical in order to survive that portion of the exam. Okay? Well, that has been done away with. And the reason is everyone now takes the same exam, which I'll explain. That means all the physicists, the computer scientists, the biologists, all the engineers were all taking the same exam. So it's technically neutral, and there's no more writing. Indeed, it is only multiple choice now, exclusively multiple choice. It is no longer administered on paper. It's administered via a computer terminal near you. There is, in fact, one instance when you can take it on paper each year, but most people do not opt for that. But once a year, the Patent Office puts it on at their facility here in Washington, D.C., usually during July, and over a period of about 2 or 3 days, they put it on for groups of about 100 or 150 until they burn through all the people who actually want to touch paper, okay, and see this book that they test called the MBED. But for the most part, people take this on a computer at a place called Prometrics. And we'll talk about what Prometrics is when I talk about how to sign up for the exam. But it is all on computer. It's all multiple choice. You're all taking the same exam. So what rumors about the exam that it's going to go away, that it involves writing and you have to be technically competent, I want you to forget about all of those rumors. So let's talk about the exam and what it is. You would think it's called the Patent Bar Exam, the Patent Registration Exam, the Patent Office Exam, all these things mean the same thing. You'd think it was a test about patent law. And in fact, it is, a little. But in truth, all the law you need to know can be put on a single sheet of paper, double-sided, literally 35 U.S.C. 101, 102, 103, 112. That's it. That's all you need to know in terms of the law. What's tested is something else. What's tested is the procedure and the rules relating to something called patent prosecution. And this is all in a book. And so the exam comes down to 100 questions, multiple choice, which means they give you the answers. How hard can it be? In addition, You have 3 hours in the morning, 50 questions, 3 hours in the afternoon, 50 questions. In truth, you have time to look up 5 questions in the morning, 5 in the afternoon. What does that mean? 90% of the exam comes from right here, okay, from your head. The hard drive, you always take with you. And so that's the problem. You have to know enough, 90% of enough, of a 3,000-page book to survive this exam. That's the truth of it, and that's what makes it difficult. People walk in with one impression or apprehension about the exam, and they finish with something very different. So there you go. So now that you're all fired up about taking this exam, who wouldn't want to take an exam with 50% pass rate? Let's talk about signing up for it, what's required.
General requirements
bulletin. General requirements bulletin. Now the reason you want this is, and you want your copy. Okay, they reissue it about every year. Sometimes they make a little tweak at some point through the year, a little twist here and there. But you want your copy because it is the application. But let me distill what is here. Number one, they want you to have a technical background. And their idea of a technical background is that you have an undergraduate degree in a science or an engineering discipline. Science or engineering discipline. Let me just read them for you quickly so you have a feel for it. Biology, biochemistry, botany, some computer science stuff, electronics technology, food technology, general chemistry, marine technology, microbiology, molecular biology, organic chemistry, pharmacology, physics, textile technology, and any engineering degree. If engineering shows up near the beginning, the middle, or the end of your diploma, you're in. Okay, engineering in there somewhere, you're probably in. So how many of you have science or engineering? Okay, well, that's most of you. You are close. You have coursework that's scientific or engineering?
Well, my diploma doesn't say 1 degree in honor. I went to a liberal arts college.
Oh, and what is it in? Biology or?
Well, concentrated chemistry.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. It doesn't have to be a BS. It can be a BA in chemistry. That's fine. So, Richard. Fair enough, everybody. Good. Because the other category is category B. Now, category B means you don't have the requisite degree, but you have something that is like the requisite degree. For example, you were on your way to a degree in music, and in fact, you got it. But on your way to getting that degree in French horn, you wanted to know how the horn worked. And so you took 24 semester hours in physics. Okay? You'd be an unusual person, but you would also qualify for this exam. So there are other ways to qualify. And that is, if you don't have the science or engineering discipline, but you have the coursework which is similar to it. And so category B is available. Now, how many people fall out of that category? Not a lot, but enough. It's the pre-med people. It's the people who went to Annapolis, West Point. They didn't get the classic education of an engineer or a scientist, but they came close. And they may be a physics course or a chemistry course or something like that. Okay, that's fine. You can make that up. And you can make it up at a future college or any other place that delivers those courses. You don't have to go to the big, expensive state school. You can knock it out in the summer, junior college, no problem. As long as it counts toward a degree in that topic. It can't be physics for history majors. Okay, or the history of chemistry. Okay, it's not a depending on whether you're category A and B, you'll be treated a little bit differently by the patent office. Category A means you'll get back an admission ticket to the exam in about a week to 10 days. A week to 10 days. If you're category B, it's going to take about 4 to 6 weeks. Okay, but they'll send it back to you. Now, what do I mean an admission ticket? An admission ticket means you can contact, schedule, and take your exam by virtue of a Prometric facility near you, or not near you as the case may be. There's about 400 to 500 of these facilities across the country. They are a third-party entity. They're an exam proctoring organization affiliated with the patent office. In fact, most often they're affiliated with a Sylvan Learning Center. And what they are is a room divided into little computer cubbies, and you can sit down at one of these computers with a little bit of desk space, and you go ahead and knock out your exam. Now, on a given day in a Prometric facility, how many people do you think are there taking the patent bar exam? Okay, you. Okay, there's not a rush to take this exam. There's about 400 or 500 of these things across the country, Prometric facilities. About 2,500, 2,800 people take the exam per year. That means about one every month per facility. Okay, so it's not exactly Katie, bar the door, here we come. It's like once in a while. The seats are available first come, first serve. So, when you get back your ticket, you have a 90-day window, 90, a 90-day window to contact, schedule, and take your exam at a Prometric facility of your choice. It may be one here, okay, in the greater Washington area. It may be one in New York. It may be one where you're going to be during the summer or the winter break or, you know, whatever. What you need to do is find a day that they have available that you want to take that exam. So you schedule your exam day whenever you want, and you don't even have to miss work or school because these places typically open on a Saturday. So you don't even have to take time off to take this. Okay, now as busy as you think you are in law school, and you probably are, can you find a day over 3 months to take an exam? And the answer is okay, not that busy. Okay, you can find it. You can even, you know, got classes on it, not this time. So, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is not that day, is it? That day you can find if you schedule it yourself. The problem is preparing for this exam, okay? Preparing. So, how much time is necessary to get ready for this thing? Well, let's talk about that. This exam is going to take you about 300 hours to prepare for if you do it yourself. And you can do it yourself. It's not completely crazy. You can go ahead and get a copy of the MPEP. Kind of heavy. You can get it for free. It's online. USPTO.gov. You go to the MPEP. MPEP. Write that up for you. Get your own copy. Now, make sure, though, that you get the copy that's being tested. The MPEP is a big, thick book. Takes a long time to edit. And so when they put out an edited version, the exam writers then take it and start to write exam questions. Takes them about a year. By the time they're done, the MPEP editors have edited another version and published it. And so the exam is out of phase with respect to the MPEP that's currently in use. Currently, there are two revisions out of phase. you're going to go from about 300 hours to 150 or so. All right, now, is this more manageable? Sure, it's more manageable. 150 hours is still a big chunk of time, but now it's a piece of the summer. It's winter break, or maybe a little bit more, or you can make a heck of a start on spring break. Now, bear in mind what these courses mean. They cost something, okay? Depending on which one you get, it goes from maybe $100,000 to, you know, over $2,000, some up to like $2,500 if you get the most expensive. What are you buying back? You're buying back your own time. So bear that in mind. Understand, yes, it costs money, but what do you get back? Well, you get time back, time that you can spend working or, you know, relaxing. I don't know what you might do with the free time, but bear that in mind. It makes your studying more efficient. Now, something else about these courses. They're typically available in two forms, like ours is, for example. Home study or live. You show up somewhere. Now, what you have to understand is which one suits you. And what I mean here is, for example, the home study. It arrives, it's, you know, a 40-pound box. And it sits there pretty much where the guy who delivered it set it down, right? It doesn't leap into action and run after your laptop or DVD player and spontaneously engage you, okay? It's not like Netflix. It's not something you're waiting for. You want to rip open and watch, okay? That's not the experience. It sits there. And unless and until you get around to it, nothing happens. And so you have to understand that if you have a personality that can work with a self-administered course, then go ahead, it's for you. Now, in the case of our materials, about, maybe 60% of our people by now are home study, maybe a little bit more. How do they do?
They did really well.
You know, maybe, what, 86, 87% pass. But what you have to understand is the course didn't take the exam. The person did. You know, as gold-plated as a course may be, and as successful as people might be with it, the course never takes an exam. So what does that indicate? It indicates we have very dedicated students. If I say 150 hours, I don't mean 120. I mean 130. It's 140 or 150 hours, okay? And I don't really care where you start from. If you have past experience, good. That'll help you, you know, understand some of the jargon. But that's a thick book, and they want you to know a lot about it. So keep that in mind. If you go with a home study version of a course, any course, keep in mind that it has to suit your personality. A lot of people succeed with it. But for me, I'd have to go with a live course because it has a date. And see, for me, if there's not a deadline, not much happens. Okay? I recognize that about my own personality. And so if you take a live course, now where are these live courses? Are they here? Well, there's one here. But they're places that cost money. Now, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, LA, that sort of thing. That means you have to go there if you don't take the one here. You have to stay there, and you have to eat while you're there. So even if a live and a home study course cost the same, understand a live course has this extra component. Unless you're staying with people, you know, family or something. So just bear that in mind. That you have to determine what suits your personality. You need that date to make it happen. You know, and a live course, I'd argue, if somebody's in front of the room, I take you through the material, you know, over a very compact period of time. It's efficient, but it's grueling, okay? It's not, let's take this slowly and talk about it. No. It's a forced march through a lot of material. But for a lot of people, that works, okay? They do pretty well. A little bit of a higher pass rate than home study, but I don't think that that's because of the difference in the course. There's no difference in the course. I think that is just the way the numbers fall. Okay, so you can do just as well either way. So pick the one that suits your personnel. Any course will help. Any course will make your study time far more efficient. Okay, next. When should I take this exam in my law school time? Alright. Well, let's take the first option. The first option being, let's do nothing. And the reason that's appealing is it requires no action on your part, okay? Inertia is the order of the day. So you let time away, and you're finished with busyness that you had in law school is now replaced by work. And here's the problem with work. The reason they're paying you all that money is because you show up early, you work hard, and you stay late. Okay? They're not giving you that money because you have a good sense of humor. Okay? They're paying you that money because you work pretty hard. And they probably already worked with you to take the regular parts in. They're giving you a nice little start date, maybe paid for a course, that sort of thing. Will they do it again? You know, maybe not. They may pay for a course, they may give you the day, you know, a Saturday, to go take the exam. But are they going to give you the time that you need to prepare? Some places might give you a little something, but most places say, good luck on the exam, here's the tough one, you've got to pass it. Good luck, you know. So, you want to take it then. Well, if that's your situation, you know, you're a 3L, and you've waited, well, I guess that's your situation. So, if you can, knock it out before you graduate. If not, try to get it out of the way before you graduate. All right, let's talk about doing it early in your law school experience. Now, let's think about it. Are you waiting for any further credential to take the exam? Does law school teach physics or chemistry or biology? No. So you're not waiting for an additional credential. You have that because of your undergraduate degree. The other thing is law school going to further prepare you for the exam? And the answer is probably not. The reason that MPEP is not usually a text in a law school course. There are a few, 5 courses. I teach 1 in Chicago in the summer, and I use the MPEP, but for the most part, law schools don't because it is big, it's difficult, but really it's not really a text. It's more of a reference for you, sort of a guide. And it is a slice of patent law. So, is anything in law school that can further prepare you? Probably not. There may be a course on patent law that makes you excited about taking the exam. But getting you ready for the exam, no. So, what are you waiting for? Well, you're waiting for you to decide this is something you want to do. And let's suppose you decide it is, and you do it. You get it on your resume. There it is, forever. You're a registered patent agent. What does that mean? That means you can write and file and prosecute applications. You can represent others before the patent office. You have the same status as a registered patent attorney. Okay. And so, what can you do while you're in law school? Well, you guys are in Washington. You can do it all. You can get part-time work. You can work as an agent somewhere. You can get that all-important experience before you graduate. I've hired 2 people from America in my law firm going through exactly that scenario. That's right. My firm, Baranata White Stavish, graduated from America. Before this nice building was built, by the way, still there about it. Because it was built with his tuition money, which I might add, I paid, so what's he there for? In any case, get it out of the way and get it on your resume. It's an experience builder and it's impressive. Because we know it's our test. And so when you get it on your resume, what does that tell the interviewer? That you're serious about this area of law. That you're already committed to it. And if you have your agency number, you can hit the ground running. What happens when you graduate? Nothing. Your status changes from registered agent to registered attorney. When you become admitted to a bar, you just tell the patent office you're admitted and your status changes. You don't have to take the exam again for anything. So how many are you going to take it before graduation? Come on, let's see what they're doing. Okay, here we go. Good plan, good plan. Are there any questions that you might have that I did not answer?
How many facts you can take?
As many times as you want. That's the beauty of it. You only have to wait 30 days and you can take it again. Now, that's something else to factor in. Suppose it is a swing and a miss. That can happen, you know. Well, wait 30 days, do it again. It's not like the regular bar.
Every 30 days you can take it?
Every 30 days. I mean, I think after a while you question your methods, but yes, sure. Now, what this requires is that you sort of be a homebody. And what I mean is you got to show up at work fairly regularly because you have a regular docket that you need to look after. You're going to have 300 or 400 cases pending at the patent office that you're attending to. The examiner will write to you, you'll write back, you communicate with clients. When you get done with that, you work on the next one. There's some issue, you'll file more. It's kind of a rolling continuum. The thing that you have to be mindful of, though, is it's very, very date-driven. And if you don't meet dates, things go bad. Very bad. And so you got to be there. You can take vacations, obviously, but you can't be gone for months. And therein lies the problem. The other thing that patent attorneys do, which is litigation. Litigation is all-consuming, and litigating a patent is like litigating anything else in federal district court. It's exclusively a federal district court undertaking. There's no crossover to state or local courts. Unlike trademarks, copyrights, and unfair trade, you get some of that spillover. Not so in patents. It's exclusively federal district court. And litigating a patent is like litigating anything else. You know, you wake up angry and you stay that way, okay, for about 10 years. And pretty much, you know, you want to do harm to the case of your opposition. Whether you're plaintiff or defendant, that's your goal, right? You want to represent your client, and so you pursue everything at all times, and typically, regardless of cost. And in patents, what that means is lots of money gets spent in short periods. The other thing is, patents, half of all U.S. patents anyway, come from outside the United States. And so when you're taking depositions, you're seeking documents and so forth, where are you? You're somewhere else. You're 12 time zones away, working on documents or depositions through an interpreter, and then there's a discovery dispute. You're arguing a motion 12 time zones that way to resolve it. You're back a month later. You're still going at it, same witness. You know, it is consuming. And because it is, it's very hard to combine litigation with prosecution. Now, prosecution requires constant care and tending. Litigation requires total commitment for the period of time that you're doing. But here's the irony. You cannot be a good litigator without understanding prosecution because the pitfalls you will exploit in a patent show up in prosecution, so you have to know what to look for. Likewise, you can't be a good prosecutor without being a good litigator because you don't want to introduce pitfalls into the file while you're prosecuting. So it's one of these Yogi Berra statements. You have to know how to do both, but you can't do both. Okay? One of those things. Now, can you do one and then do the other and then do that one and then do the other? You can start out prosecuting and you decide you're angry, litigate, but then you're not so angry, you know, the medications are... And you can go back and forth between these things depending on what you feel like doing. Now, early in your career, I'm going to suggest you try and do both. Yeah, burn that candle at both ends because you want to know which you like. And so I urge you to give a shot at doing litigation support, writing motions and arguing things and stuff, and then try some prosecution, do both, and see which one suits you. But eventually, you'll pick one or the other. Door number one, door number two. Now, what is in between? Well, in between is licensing and transactional stuff, opinion work. Either a prosecuting attorney or a litigating attorney, patent attorney, can do either of these things. Okay, transactional stuff, paperwork. All right, now, where do attorneys do this? Where do patent attorneys show up? Well, increasingly, the job is at a general practice firm in their patent group. Now, this is a fairly recent development in patent law. In the last 10 or 15 years, you've had patent groups show up in general practice firms. Now, what does that mean? Well, what it means is 10 or 15 years ago, the general practice firm existed, had no patent people. But they began to read about these titanic sums being spent in patent litigation. Yeah, how much does it cost to litigate a patent? In the year 2001, Northern District of California, it cost about $1.92 million to litigate a single patent from one side to trial. tears of joy. The general practice insurance. Okay? Those kind of fees at that kind of rate, they cry when they hear about it. Okay, so the clients likewise cry for different reasons, but they want to get a hold of this. How do you get there? You get yourself some patent attorneys. And so what general practice firms done, they have acquired boutiques, merged with them, and all that sort of thing. And so increasingly, there is a patent group at a general practice firm. Now, what do you do there? Well, litigation, prosecution, transactions, all that sort of thing. Do it all. And probably as much of it as you want. You know, these big general practice firms tend to get pretty big departments. Some are small, but most are enough to handle whatever comes their way. Now, the other place you can go and work is a boutique. Now, boutique has a couple of implications. One is that it's not so big. The other is that there's specialization. Well, let's talk about size. Here in Washington, there's a couple of boutiques that do patent work, and they're pretty big. Obalon, Shabroom, Finnegan. These places have 200 to 300 attorneys. It hardly sounds small. The other thing is specialization. These firms tend to do patent work, and when they say things on their website like IP law, okay, what do they mean? They mean patents 98% of the time. Why? Because anybody can do trademarks and copyrights. That's right. You don't have to have a science background. So they'll do trademarks and copyrights and, you know, entertainment law and that sort of thing and unfair trade. But typically it's ancillary to the patent. What I mean is you have a patent case, they stole your invention, chances are they ripped off your trademark, they're counterfeiting it, and they took your instructions and your packaging. So you have a trademark, trade dress, copyright, and a patent. So it's all in one. So you do other work, but that's called soft IP. Typically a patent firm that is mostly patent attorneys does patents. That's pretty much what you do. And that's distinct from a general practice firm where you might have the opportunity to do something else that you found interesting in law school. You know, there are other interesting things going on in law school. It's not just about patents. You'd think it was. I mean, you probably know that the third public building built in Washington, D.C. after the Capitol and White House was the patent office. You knew that. The only building the British did not burn, they burned Washington. The patent office. Yeah. They burned the White House to leave her out. Yeah. But not the patent office. Why? Because there's a lot of technology. But it's not all about patents, and that's the thing. When you're in law school, you might find other things interesting as well. If you're in a general practice firm, you might have that chance. At a patent firm, you know, you tend to go off with your pocket protector wearing friends, and that's it. Okay, you never see your peer group again. They heard you went into patent law, and that's the last they saw. All right. So bear that in mind. Patent firms tend to do patent work. Now, what's the difference between a large boutique and a smaller one? Less opportunity for litigation. The smaller the boutique, the less litigation. Not no litigation, just not as much. You know, a case every other year. Whereas at a big boutique, you litigate all day, every day, 365. Okay, there's plenty of work. There's the resources there. All right, where else can you work? Well, a university. Universities have patent attorneys. They're trying to exploit tech transfer, take advantage of things that professors come up with. What do you do? Probably prosecution, maybe a little licensing, no litigation. You might write a threatening letter, but you're not going to be arguing motions, taking depositions, arguing cases. You could work at a company, you know, go in-house. What does that mean? Well, it depends on the company. Some companies, you play traffic comp. You're just directing work to outside lawyers. Other times, there's actually a staff there that you work in or administer, and they actually do patent prosecution, maybe a little licensing, that sort of thing. Not much litigation, probably none. I mean, they manage it. They get witnesses ready. They do document discovery. They don't argue motions and that sort of thing. is 15, and if you're familiar with the government pay scale, that's not a bad living. Okay, save indoor work. Go home every night. Not bad. She is 15. All right. Let's talk about where jobs are in the United States. Well, you happen to be in a target-rich environment. About 20% of the entire patent bar in the United States is within 25 miles of this law school. How? Pretty special, I bet. Most are in Northern Virginia. The rest are in D.C. Many live in Maryland, but do not practice in Maryland. I don't know why, but not many people practice patent law in Maryland. Instead, they're in the district, and then, of course, Northern Virginia, where the patent office is. And the reason there's so many patent attorneys around here is, of course, the patent office here, but also half of all U.S. applications start outside the country. So if you need a patent in the United States, you're in Germany, where are you going to send it? San Francisco? You're going to send it to someone near the patent office. So what's in D.C.? Every technical discipline, biology, chemistry, physics, computer science, whatever it is you've got, there's a job here for you somewhere. Probably in the government, in a big boutique, small boutique, general practice firm, maybe a university. Not so many companies. There are some companies here. You know, Lockheed Martin and Intelsat. You know, there are government-related in some respect. Not many, though. Washington is not a company town unless you go. All right, where else? New York. New York, I include Northern New Jersey, Connecticut, and Long Island, of course. And there you have about half the number you do in the greater Washington, Northern Virginia area. But now, instead of government jobs, you have a lot of company jobs. A lot of companies, especially in pharma and chemical, especially in Northern New Jersey. But New York is a traditional center of commerce and all that sort of thing. What do you find? All disciplines, all jobs, big boutiques, small, general practice, universities, companies, all share, just not so much government. What's next? Well, Chicago. Chicago has about half the number that are in New York, about 8,900, or in Illinois. What are they doing here? Well, a little bit of everything. Chicago, again, has a pretty broad spectrum. Some companies are out there, Motorola, Boeing, and so forth, plus big boutiques, small, general practice, universities. Again, not so many government jobs. What's next? California. Now, California, the state, has as many patent attorneys as Washington and Northern Virginia, but it's the whole state as opposed to two circuits. Okay, so it's kind of spread out. Now, what's going on in California? Well, it's regional. Northern California, that's San Francisco, Silicon Valley, the Bay Area. You can have chip software, maybe a little bio. Middle California, Santa Barbara, you get Genentech, Amgen, you got UC Santa Barbara, a little bit of biotech. LA, you have a little bit of everything everywhere. If you're familiar with LA, there's no there there. It's not just the people, it's the place. Okay, it's kind of spread out. You have Pasadena, downtown, Century City, Santa Monica, Long Beach, Newport, Orange County. You have it a little bit everywhere. It's a little bit of everything, old remnants of fence work and so forth, but Southern Cal is jumping. You know, there's lots of stuff down there. San Diego. Defense, chips, bio. Scripps is down there, obviously Navy, and Qualcomm. Okay, what is in the desert southwest? Nothing. Cactus, okay? Until you get to Phoenix, and then there's about 300, 250, 300 patent attorneys hanging around Phoenix, Motorola, Intel. You keep going across the desert southwest, and what's out there? Nothing. Until you get to Sandia Labs in Albuquerque and Los Alamos, they're all government people, about 150 out there. Good skiing up in Santa Fe are not worth it. There is no work in Florida for patent attorneys. Okay? But there's 500 of them down there. All right. We go to the Carolinas. What do we have? NASCAR, okay, barbecue, and Research Triangle. About 300 patent attorneys, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. Innovation in Washington, you're in pretty good shape. You know, there's lots of jobs available for you, and this is a good school. That's nice to know. Just kidding. I hired people from here. I don't need you. All right. You'll do fine, but prepare to be portable, okay? And you may have to go somewhere for the job you want. It may not be in your backyard, although here you're shot at. One in five jobs are sitting right out of your back door, so don't get greedy. But in any case, if you know, you want to live in a place where the surf report is meaningful in February, that's San Diego, okay? You got to go. There's no job for you in Ocean City. It's in San Diego. So be prepared to go somewhere to get your job, and you'll do fine. Any questions on careers? How many people want to be back here? See? It'll work. All right. Well, have fun. Question?
I was just wondering if you had any advice on what's good summer experience so far as like what employers are looking for.
Well, employers are looking for you to have some skills that you can hit the ground running. You know, so actual prosecution experience, actual litigation experience is useful. You know, so if you prepare a few motions for argument on the litigation side, or you write up a few specifications on the prosecution side, that's good. If you do research papers, well, you know, that's a shame. So, I know that's a summer solution. Get into the library or get into that computer terminal. I don't want to see you for 3 weeks. You know, research this. Try to avoid that. Because real experience is kind of what
you're say there's a hypothetical 1L with a science background who's looking for a job part-time. He's a part-time student, hypothetically.
Someone part-time. So you have a friend.
I have a friend.
Yeah. Who has exactly this circumstance. Okay, this is what you do. Get on the patent office website. Look up some patents that have technology you feel that you can deal with, write, file, and handle. You understand right away. Find the law firms in the Washington area, Northern Virginia, that handle those applications. Because they'll be written right there on the front of the patent. Say, I can do what you need done.
Hypothetically, think, what if that were tried previously? Yes, and
try it again. Be more charismatic. Try not to get faster. I mean, patent attorneys suffer from a lack of personality. What's the joke? We lack sufficient personality to do tax work.
Is that like a growing practice, like WIPO?
Yeah. Oh, well, two parts to your question. Okay. How much international work and where do you do it from? I suppose you'd like to live in Paris and be an American patent, let's say. Is that achievable? Not really. I mean, yes, but the caveat is you got to have great foreign language skills, and bear in mind that they probably speak English better than you speak French or German. And that's not because we're so parochial, it's that they learn the languages and been forced to, you know, we haven't. And so they can pretty much do see anything that you had any formal training about come in the door as an application to work on? Zero chance.
Does it matter, like, what you did your specialization in?
No, it only matters to you because it's going to limit what you think you can do. You're going to think, well, that's what I'm supposed to do, so I guess I have to focus on that, and you really ought not to. You ought to work on anything that shows up that you feel you can. Any other questions?